Questions from the audience that I have on the iPad. So somebody who's had a failed transplant from a living donor, what are the odds of a successful retransplant from another living donor who's closely related to the first donor? Are there any statistics or guidelines on that? So I think both Tony and Ken respond to that.
So if it's a really well-matched living donor, such as a brother or sister who's a two-haplotype match, then that recipient, even though they failed the transplant for some other reason, probably is not going to be immunized. But you just don't know who's going to be immunized. You just have to get the data, and then any potential donor can come forward, and we would do cross-matching, and if it's possible to do it, we would. We do positive cross-match transplants, too. We desensitize the recipient and allow that to happen. Another option, if still that's a barrier, you can do paired exchange, which we're involved with as well. So in this last year, we increased our paired exchange program by 300%, and I encourage every transplant program to get involved with that.
Absolutely. If someone has a living donor, they have a home run. They should be able to get a transplant more quickly. And as alluded to, the ability to sense allosensitization is very good these days. We could follow that. Our transplant nephrologists actually run a clinic, a transition clinic, for patients who have a failing first graft and who are candidates for a second transplant, because they do want to manage the baseline maintenance immunosuppression and they don't want to try to sensitize the patients. Everyone uses a different chicken soup, but as your grandmother knows, all chicken soups taste wonderful. So we tend to be a little bit more on the anti-proliferatives, a little bit more on the MPAs to try to decrease alloantibody formation. We follow these patients closely. If they do have allograft dysfunction, we're right there as a surgical team, so we'll try to address that. And when we do remove transplant allografts, we increase their immunosuppression. So we will not only do a big steroid taper, as you alluded to get the swelling down initially, but we'll carry on the taper for a while and keep them on higher dose baseline immunosuppression for several weeks to several months. There's some data in the very old literature using azathioprine that it decreased sensitization over time. It's partially a religious belief, but it doesn't tend to hurt people, so we do it. But the paired exchange is number one home run. In fact, our team is doing one today that I'm out of town. But you find someone who has a living donor, you get them in a paired exchange, you should be able to get them another living donor kidney.
We're going to flip to Roberto. So if you get somebody tuned up on their ESA and their hemoglobins at target, and you say you have their iron at target, is there anything you can do at that point to decrease the ESA dose and cost? So you've got hemoglobin where you want it, you've got iron where you want it. Is there anything else you can do?
I mean, you can take a look at the iron, because one thing is to have enough iron. The other thing is at what level, up to what level you can go, and then you can look at the ferritin levels and try to push it towards that safety.
What would that be, 1,200?
Well, if you take, in dialysis, for instance, we do have more data, and Pivotal is a good example that it's around 1,100, and when you use that in a protocol for the aggressive arm in Pivotal, there was no sign of unsafe. There was no unsafety signs. In at least from a cardiovascular perspective, was even a reduction in cardiovascular risk, which was the primary endpoint. So I think it's really trying to respect the thresholds for safety and push closer to that limit. With that way, clearly, at least in dialysis, you can spare. There's some data on non-dialysis too that you can actually spare some ESA when you provide IV iron at lower thresholds of ferritin.
For Dr. Langone, does the increase in immune suppression for patients on dialysis depend on the history of the prior PRA and behavior with that kidney, rejection, acute rejection, chronic rejection, etc.?
So once again, every center does it differently. When our patients fail and go on to dialysis, their PRA does not necessarily mean that they're going to acutely reject the kidney. So we still taper them the same. If their PRA is 100 or PRA is 0, we still taper their CNI over the first month. And then, as I stated before, we've been keeping them on prednisone, and that seems to lead to their nephrectomy. It's usually the sensitizing event, like a cold or something like that, that seems to bring out the acute rejection. And yes, of course, if you went cold turkey off your immunosuppression, you would see the kidney ramp up as well. The greatest example of this, and I don't know if you guys got this in Florida, but when Katrina occurred in 2005, a lot of patients were displaced from New Orleans, and they didn't have their meds, and they came up to Nashville and other places. And those were like the old rejections when we only had azathioprine and prednisone. And these patients were really hot kidneys, and they had, you know, and they had to be treated and often had to lose their nephrectomy, by nephrectomy. But no, we don't. Base PRA is not the reason why I change or do any change in their immunosuppression.
Any comments, Ken?
And I would say that the worst acute rejections we see now are actually in the children, because they do stop all their medicines. So unfortunately, if they stop their medicines for a while, the kidneys are really hot, and the trick of starting high-dose steroids for 3, 4, 5 days really helps. Because when you do open these up, the kidney will crack and they can bleed. So a couple of days of steroids isn't a delay tactic. It's to do a safer operation.
I want to add to that. So I know there's a lot of pediatricians in the audience, which is great. I'm glad there's a lot of interest in transplant and nephrology in pediatrics. The kids, what's interesting about them is a lot of them turn 18, even though they've had an allograft for 10 years, and they stop their meds then. And it's actually women more often than men, 18 to 25 years old. There's a lot of reasons for that, but they just go cold turkey, and it's amazing. We actually believe, even though preemptive transplantation is the way to go, there's no doubt about it. Every paper supports that. In certain populations, such as children, it might actually be better that, well, not really young children, but like adolescents, those that can understand, that they sense or get a taste of what dialysis is like, so they know what the alternative is, and they remember that, so they don't stop their meds.
I'll put a plug in for Dr. Ferris, or you can have a good transition program that educates them ahead of time, hopefully, and has them not stop their medicines.
Are there any data on the outcomes of patients on dialysis who had had a previous transplant and compare them to anything else, either other transplant survivors who obviously maintain their transplant versus non-transplanted dialysis patients? Are there any comparative outcome data?
Well, I think I mentioned people who failed their allografts and have gone back on dialysis have far worse outcomes than those who are naive, transplant naive.
Well, but there's two types of transplant naive. Those are those wait listed and those never wait listed. And I think that's the gist of that question.
Right. All comers, it's still worse than if they're transplant naive. Yes, it would even be worse if you just use the transplant population, because there's a bias associated with that. Transplant by itself, better outcomes. Transplant naive patients versus transplant failed patients, the transplant naive patients on dialysis tend to do better as a whole.
I would agree, but you actually can't predict any individual patient. So some patients who lose their first graft early may have a second graft that lasts 20 years, and it does occur with enough frequency that we see it in our practices at every single center. And again, these days, probably the subsequent outcomes are better because we're better at finding lower levels of alloantibody sensitization. So if the patient is not that highly sensitized and we can completely avoid any prior alloantibody, the outcomes are pretty good. It's just in the super highly sensitized patients, it's hard to avoid all minor levels of alloantibody sensitization, and that may increase over time.
Roberto, we've got an audience that's very interested in HIF stabilizers. Are there any known risks for malignancy in the use of HIF stabilizers in the few thousand people that have been exposed to them?
And the shorter follow-up that is in the data published until now, there's no imbalance in terms of malignancy.
And I know physicians that are on two of the DSMBs for two of the different products. Yeah. And when I asked them about cardiac outcomes and pulmonary hypertension, in particular pulmonary hypertension, the answer from both of them were there's no signal. And then I said, well, do you know the difference between a forearm fistula and an upper arm fistula and pulmonary hypertension? Oh, we didn't look at that. So, that, first of all, the studies are fairly small. You quoted the numbers, but and the significance that I keep asking the question about pulmonary hypertension is that HIF stabilizers, all of them, the PHI inhibitors, they decrease nitrous oxide synthesis in the pulmonary vasculature. And my patients with upper arm fistulas, they have blood flows through there 1,200 to 2,000 milliliters a minute, blasting right into their right side of their heart. So I have some concerns about that. And this question was about malignancy, but I think these are going to be really neat agents, but I think we don't know yet all the implications.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I'm really looking forward to the publication of the safety results, because as I mentioned during my presentation, Tom, the decision of the company supporting the ROXA trials, there too, the fibrogen and AZ, they decided to go for a pooled data analysis in terms of safety. So that was a presentation at the ASN that we all saw. And in general, you can see no major signals, including no cardiovascular signals. Actually, in a subgroup of patients incident on dialysis, there was a reduction in MACE compared to ASA, which is promising. But I think it's a very complicated design. It will be a difficult process, editorial process for publication. I mean, to have major journals accepting that approach, and even I don't know how FDA is going to see that, but I think really to capture individual problems, it might take longer because of the numbers. So we need to probably combine the other programs in, for the other HIF stabilizers to be able to look at things like that. And I'm not sure how granular the data would be for things like what you mentioned, for instance, fistula. So it's challenging.
Okay, now for my two transplant colleagues, and you brought this on yourself, Dr. Andreoni. What can be done to improve communication between dialysis centers and transplant centers? And let me comment.
You'd like to communicate.
When I heard you comment that you called in a patient who had died, I thought, well, what was the most recent PRA that you requested?
Okay. So actually, the patient had died less than a month ago. So we actually had blood from 2 months prior. But it does happen. So I think every center, again, does it differently, and most don't do it well. Probably from the dialysis unit side, it's similar. It's easier in some places, and one of my prior programs, one of our transplant coordinators was a head dialysis unit nurse, and so communication was very nice and very easy. We try to communicate, like I said, we try to call referring nephrologist either before the patient leaves the hospital after a transplant or at the first visit back. We do have people on the phone contacting dialysis units regularly to try to see what our status changes. And I think until everything is easily available electronically, it's not going to be perfect. That's the best I could say.
And that was grade C, but it's a good try, Ken.
I would add on the nephrology side, we were criticized for this. We, like I said before, 22 states, at last count, I think there's over 250 nephrologists that refer to us. And one of the complaints we heard when we went into the community was that they weren't getting enough information back. And so what we instituted was a quarterly report now, so they know who's on the list and what their status is, which they didn't know before. Two, and sometimes it helps because they'll call us and say that patient's not really a candidate anymore or never really was, and they didn't know that they got referred. But anyway, so that's one thing. The other thing with Epic, which we converted to in 17, is every one of our notes now is being sent to the nephrologist. So they're at least seeing the chronic follow-up of the patients. And there's always a number for them to call if there's a concern. But it's still not perfect.
Is there any future in international organ sharing?
There actually already is some international organ sharing with Canada. So if all U.S. centers decline, especially a pediatric liver, there may be some sharing up north. There's a lot of federal rules involved here. So some groups, especially in kidney pair donation, have proposed sharing across boundaries, especially for folks of certain ethnic groups who needed to see a certain type of antigen phenotype. So it's possible. I just think it's not extremely necessary right now. There's a lot more problems we can solve at home.
And the even though it's a worldwide need, the United States has got the greatest shortcomings, so I don't think it would be a fair exchange with anybody. In addition to that, when you have live donation from other countries, that's problematic as well. We've done it 20, 30 times, but you have no follow-up with these patients. So really, at least you vet the person and as best you can get the data. But unlike our donors, where if something goes wrong, especially related to surgery, they're free to come back to the center. And if they go back to, you know, South America or something, we don't know what happens to them.
Tony, if a patient has a sluggish early function, or any other of their pertinent early history with the transplant, is there any of that information that can be useful to the nephrologist after that patient comes back to dialysis? Is there any special approach that they should know above and beyond what you said about the withdrawing of immune suppression?
Well, I think prior rejection history and such, but if the allograft has slow graft function or delayed graft function and then still has a good outcome, I don't think that has a real implication once the patient's back on dialysis. So I think, but if there's like a recent rejection, that would be very important for the nephrologist to know, because, you know, say we treated them with thymoglobulin, that patient could be at risk for CMV and other things that are opportunistic that, we probably would follow those a little closer if they had a recent rejection. But if they were back on dialysis, they should know about those kinds of events.
So Tony and I work together, and so it makes me think that we probably need to have probably a checklist form of communication between us to know that. Yeah. I can't possibly call you every time, but having a heads up warning would be good. And it goes to what we were talking about between communication between the dialysis unit and the.
Actually, what's a real working relationship that's extremely important to the patient is a patient who leaves the hospital early after transplant in delayed graft function. And so many times these patients are going back to their home nephrologist, and our transplant nephrologist and the home nephrologist need to be in excellent communication. So the worst thing we want to do is immediately get back to the dry weight and increase the density of the delayed graft function and even risk thrombosis. So there needs to be a real communication. And a good thing is, you know, a lot of the fellows, the people who trained around us are around us geographically. So they may have trained at our center 10, 20 years ago. So there's a lot of active communication. You know, Mrs. Smith is leaving. She's 8 kilos up. Can you do no more than 1 kilo dialysis run? And we'll see them back once or twice a week. And as the urine output increases, there'll be those calls of, hey, can we skip a dialysis session? And everyone hates when they get that call, right? Oh, no, I can't skip a dialysis session at the center. But we need to do that. We need to somehow pull back and have the natural experiment play itself. Does the urine output pick up? Does their clearance start to pick up? And when do we stop the dialysis? So that's a very high-level, active two-way communication between a transplant center and the practicing nephrologist in the community.
Yeah, I think in that circumstance, you almost, as a transplant center, want those patients to stay, but they can't. I mean, you can't. Sometimes it takes. In fact, I think there's a record case that opened up 200 days after the transplant. I mean, these are ATNs, and just like you had an acute kidney injury in the community, you know, you don't want to dialyze them to oblivion, because you'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So these patients, any sign, even a doubling from 150 to 300 cc's of urine, is a big deal, and you have to be very judicious with them. And the nephrologist in the community has to be more involved too. I mean, let's be honest. When you go to the dialysis unit, you might show up once a month. You've got nurse practitioners helping you. You've got your nurses doing the majority of the work. In these patients, you've got to be on them because you've got to look for small changes.
We're going to come back to a question. Roberto, you partially answered it before, but this one's a little more blunt in its questioning. Does the ferritin matter if the patient has a low TSAT?
Yeah, so it's that endless discussion about which one is the best biomarker for, you know, decisions you make. And I think we are still not in the position to really analyze just one. Obviously, if both of them are low, there's no doubt. If ferritin is low, there's no doubt. The main problem is the confounder of a higher ferritin level, the confounder of especially inflammation into the high ferritin levels. I still think that TSAT is a very good biomarker for iron deficiency. At the very low levels, and perhaps a good biomarker for, you know, potential iron overload at the very high levels of TSAT too. I think the value of ferritin is mainly as the best marker for iron deficiency when it's very low. At a high level, I think you need to analyze together with inflammation, and this could be a very thorough clinical evaluation or the introduction of CRP that I know is not very common in U.S. practice. But, you know, if you ask a Japanese nephrologist, they'll say, I need the CRP levels to really make decisions about iron status and anemia together with TSAT and ferritin.
So your comments about iron and its role in muscle and in survival, I immediately thought of the paper that Jeff Locke wrote. I have to make a disclosure here. I've been on the Akebia ad board, so that puts me at a conflict of interest. But what do you want to comment on the paper that Jeff wrote on iron and...
So that's the oral iron, in non-dialysis. As a supplement, even when you take it as a phosphate binder, and in that trial it was very small, but there was a signal on improved survival in patients taking the iron supplement as a binder, and I think the numbers are very low, though. I mean, it's very hard to take something from there, but I mean, if you look at the cardiovascular literature, especially in heart failure, the iron supplement, even in patients that are non-anemic, is associated with improvement in ejection fraction, improvement in the you know, functional status of heart failure, and reduction in hospitalization. It makes total sense that this should be tested at least in the appropriate trial in non-dialysis and also in dialysis patients, using endpoints for iron replacement despite of hemoglobin levels and despite of the, you know, traditional approach that iron is used to provide higher or better response to ESA.
It says zero time.
Come on,
Tony Bryce. Thank you all. I guess we're done.